First thing I'm going to do when I get home is look her sister up and get the real story. Get the truth. My name is Sissy Country, and I'm an Al-Anon from Alabama. Roll Tide. We have one War Eagle fan in this entire convention. That's not going to work. Country, yes, that's my last name. I married a Bob Country, and I live in the country, in Alabama. There was some fear earlier that I was running a little late, that they were going to get Kitty up here to fill in for me again, and she said she was going to have to change her accent real quick. About an hour ago, a couple hours ago, I was getting ready for this thing and got in the shower to get ready, and I made one heck of a talk in the shower. Boy, it was good. Y'all were a great audience. God let me make the time talk I wanted to make. Got to say everything I wanted to say. And now I get up here and forget everything. Been working on it forever and just goes right out one ear and one out of the other. Just woo. A couple of things I need to do before I get started. First of which is thank the committee for getting us out here, bringing us all the way from Alabama. Took a couple of planes and a rental truck, but it got us here. And hit the ground running, been running ever since, been running late ever since, but that's just the way we go. We got here Tuesday, came in a couple of days early to visit with some friends, and we have really had a good time. Being from the South, we're brought up on Southern hospitality, and we pride ourselves on knowing how to treat people when they come to town to visit, but I'm going back telling them a thing or two about hospitality because you guys really know how to treat people. So you should... I will go home with some great stories about how you folks up here at the North Coast Roundup treat your invited guests, and you should really pat yourselves on the back about that. Being in this program for a couple of days has taught me a thing or two, and I hope to share that with you as I go along. When I talked to Chris on the email I told her, I said, I think I'm driving Harlan crazy. I said, because that's the one I've been talking to. And I said, bless his heart, I think I'm just driving him crazy. It's so nice to talk to an Al-Anon. And I said, now I know I can drive you crazy. And she was telling us some things about this place, and we've been able to see some of the sights and enjoy it. And Bob, my husband, is with me, and you'll hear a little bit about him. He won't be able to get up here and rebuttal that, so I'm grateful for that. A couple of things I bring with me when I share, one of which is a watch. Not that I have a specific time or that I'm going to use my watch of any sort, but it just makes me feel good to have it up here. Just one of those things that makes you feel good. Another thing that I bring with me when I share is my Courage to Change book. And I won't use it while I'm up here. It's nothing that I use or reflect with while I'm here, but I look down and I'll see that it's here and it just makes me feel good. It's one of those things. But the third thing that I bring with me when I share, and I didn't bring enough for all of you, is some Kleenex. And I always bring Kleenex with me when I share because I'll cry. It's one of the things I do when I share. It's just part of my story. When I get to certain parts, when I share specific things, is that I will cry. And so that's one of the things that I will use today when I share with you is some Kleenex. Because I used to have a problem standing before you sharing specific things about my life and crying. I was very uncomfortable about that. I didn't like it. And it made me feel weak. It made me feel just out of sorts, real uncomfortable. And I didn't like it. But I would take my Kleenex and I would use it and I would still be real uncomfortable. And one day back home, a seasoned veteran came up and he set me straight about that. And we call our old timers back home, we call them seasoned veterans. It just sounds better than an old timer. So we call them seasoned veterans. And a seasoned veteran came up to me and patted me on the back one day and he said, Sissy, you got to get over this crying thing. He said, because don't you know the more you cry, the less you pee. I thought about that for a minute, and I thought, that's not true. But I like it. So I may stand up here and cry all afternoon, but I may not pee the rest of the day either. And that's okay. But it sure made me, it set me free about feeling weird about it. So, but like I said, I don't have enough to go around. You'll have to get your own. And I brought enough for me. And, you know, certain things happen. They just happen in my life. Coincidences? I don't think so. I think they're just meant to happen in Sissy's life. And I want to share with you one of the things that happened to me yesterday. Happened to me and Bob. Bob and I have a new friend in our life. Her name is Kathy. And I can't go into the specific details about the circumstance, but I will tell you that she's from this area and she's in this program. And she doesn't have a whole lot of time in this program, but if you people keep doing what you're doing in your meetings and making her feel a part of and helping her to keep coming back, she'll soon have the kind of recovery I hope the rest of you have. And she's not able to be in this meeting today. She's not able to be at this convention this weekend. But she is around this weekend. And we're fortunate enough, we were very blessed to meet this young lady and spend a few minutes with her. And that's something that God blessed us with for just a few minutes yesterday. And that's one of those things that I would have missed out on had I not been at the right place at the right time. And that's one of the things I think you can understand. I have a member of Al-Anon. I'm not a cheerleader of Al-Anon, and I'm not one that goes to the meetings just because my significant other or my little alcoholic in my life happens to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm involved in Al-Anon and all aspects of the program. My serenity date, not the date that I became serene, but the date that the process was started, September the 4th, 1982. And for that, I'm truly grateful. My primary alcoholic in my life is my mom. She's the one that qualified me for this program. There's a rumor going around that there's a couple out there named Bo and Shirley that I know a little bit about. And just set that rumor straight. Yep, they belong to me. I claim them and they claim me. They're my parental unit. And my mother Shirley is our little alcoholic. And my dad Bo is my partner in Al-Anon. And growing up, I was part of the All-American family. In Hueytown, Alabama. If you know anything about NASCAR, you've heard of Hueytown, Alabama. Yeah. If you know anything about NASCAR racing, you've heard of Hueytown. And that's where I grew up, spent the first 20 years in my life in that little city. And we had the All-American family. We had a mom, a dad, a boy, and a brother and a sister, two dogs, and a little house on a little street. And it looked straight out of Norman Rockwell. Mike and I, my brother and I, were 17 months apart. He was older. I was the youngest. We had an elementary school half a block down the street. Excuse me. We had friends in the neighborhood. It was kind of neighborhood where you didn't have to lock the front door, where you could stay out and play under the street lamp till 10:30 at night. No, you didn't grow up watching TV. You grew up outside playing. You could go in and out of the neighbor's house. Everybody knew one another, but we had something going on in our family that was a little different than what went on in everybody else's family. My mom was a kitchen alcoholic, kitchen drinker. She would stop on her way home from work at the grocery store, and with a loaf of bread, a dozen eggs, she would pick up a bottle of wine. We called her our little wineette. the guys that drank were winos, and the ladies that drank were winettes, and she was our little winette. And my mom would stop at home on the way home from work at the grocery store and pick up groceries and boxes of cereal and Pop-Tarts and put a couple of bottles of wine in the grocery cart. And she would come home and she'd start to cook dinner, and halfway through fixing dinner, she'd fall out. And I didn't know at the time that she was passing out. I just knew that she fell out. And wherever she fell out was where she stayed. Mike and I just learned to kind of throw a blanket over her and walk over. And life went on. We would finish up dinner, and Mom would just kind of stay fell out. And sometimes she would get up and make it on to the bedroom, and sometimes she wouldn't. And this went on for several years in our house. And we didn't have big elaborate showdowns and throwdowns and things like that. That's just the way it was. You could walk up and down our street at night, and you could see the big drapes open in other people's living rooms and the big wooden doors open. And you could walk by our house, and you wouldn't see that. The drapes were always closed, and the big front door was always shut. And we didn't scream and holler and rant and rave. We kind of had an unwritten rule in our house, and that was, if you couldn't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. So we didn't talk. It's just a lot of silence growing up. We just kind of didn't talk. We just kind of did what was next. Step over you, walk around you, and go on. And the show would be over about 7:30 at night, and we'd kind of go in our own direction. Mike might hop on his little dirt bike and go over to a friend's house. I might go and hide out in my bedroom. Mom might stay past falling out on the floor. Dad might stay at work late, and we'd get up and do it all again the next day. And that's how it would go in our house for a while. And then things would start to happen. We would come home from school and the water would be cut off, or the power would be cut off. I can remember the big orange sign or the green sign, the big fluorescent colored sign on the front door that said something had been cut off. Yeah. I can remember growing up and never having friends over, because you never knew what was going to happen, you know. So you didn't want to have that to deal with. And you never talked about it. You certainly never sat down and talked about it and said, well, it's not a real good idea that you don't have friends over. You just kind of knew what you didn't do next. These are things that growing up in a family involved in alcoholism just taught you, you know. And it's amazing how even today I sit around and I hear people say, you know, my drinking didn't affect my kids. You know, and I think back to those times of rounding the corner from the school and looking down the street to see if I could see that bright orange green card hanging on the front door, hoping none of the neighbors could see it, knowing that they could, you know. And I was probably 11 years old when all this was happening. And I can remember that the roles had reversed between me and my mom. She became the daughter and I became the mother. Because my mother tried to raise me and teach me things that every daughter should be raised knowing. Like how to fold a load of laundry and how to wash a load of dishes. How to keep your room straight. Now, these are things that I was just not willing to learn. Because if my mother tried to teach me, then I would come at her and I would say, you know, I don't want to do this. And if you make me, then I'm going to tell Dad how much you've been drinking. And she'd back off. Real quick. You know, at 10, 11 years old, I had this kind of power over her. And I could go to her and I could say, I need $5. And then I could go to my dad and I could say, I need $5, because she wouldn't give it to me. And I knew they'd never talk. And I kind of had the best of both worlds. And these are the little manipulation things that I learned through alcoholism that nobody ever sits down and tells you you're going to learn. You just figure it out as you go along. And I hear people say, my drinking never affected my kids. And it's insane. It's absolutely insane. And so we function this way as a family, you know. And I would go and I would spend, you know, I would spend time with my other relatives. And I would go to these family reunions. I always hated going to these family reunions on 4th of July and Labor Day, because these people would look at me. And I knew they were talking about us. And they would ask me, how are things going? You know, and you'd straighten up, and you'd put that smile on, and you'd tell them everything's just fine. Yeah. Meanwhile, my brother's failing in his grade, and I'm making straight A's. Who knew? You know, to look at us, we looked like the All-American family. We had all the stuff you could want. You know, we had all the latest stuff. We had the newest cars. Our house looked just like theirs, probably a little better. You know, we had all the latest stuff. Mike and I never grew up hearing the word no. You know. But at home, we couldn't find anything to talk about. Certainly couldn't talk nicely about one another and never had anything to say. You know. And that's the way we were functioning. My parents didn't know that I was crying myself to sleep every night, every single night of my life, because I couldn't figure out a way to make my mom stop drinking. You know, they didn't know that at age 12, I was thinking about suicide because I couldn't figure out a way to make my mom stop drinking. Because you don't talk about that, you know? You don't talk about that. They didn't know that every night my dad would sit up in the living room when everybody else had gone to sleep and sit in his recliner and cry because he couldn't figure out a way to make his wife stop drinking. That he was so helpless. His family was falling apart. You don't go and talk about those things. And we were four people running around in this house living four different lives. You know, and the relationship between me and my mother just kept getting worse and worse and worse. My brother and I, 17 months apart in age, physically could not stay in a room without fighting. Could not be in the same room without just lighting into one another. You know, because my brother was always trying to protect my mom. He didn't want to see her get in trouble. You know, and I was the first one to run to my dad to let him know how much she'd been drinking. So we'd broken up into teams. And that's the way, you know, alcoholism came in and hit us pretty quick and dirty. Didn't take long, but it was heavy and it was hard. I don't know how many times my mother had told us, this time it's going to be different. You know, this time I'm going to stop and I'm going to stay stopped. I just knew that I tuned out that a long time ago, you know. Alcoholism's it's a cunning, baffling, and powerful disease. Because while this is going on inside our house, my mother is the most popular person on the block in terms of, you know, our friends. She's the one that's voted team mom every year, room mother, field trip mom. You know, she's the one that's voted all these things. You know, and I can still, you know, I can still remember the year that she was our softball team mom. And she's the one that's supposed to come to the practices and bring the cookies and the, you know, Kool-Aid and all that. And most mothers will just drive up to practice and drop it off. You know, my mom comes across left field during practice and runs out of gas. You know, oh man, that's just, there's not a rock big enough to go and hide under when something like that happens. You know, and everybody else just thought it was great. Just thought that was the funniest thing in the world. You know, and there's just not a rock you can find big enough to go and... And then we still laugh about that. And, well, she doesn't. But we do. We still get a kick out of stuff, some of the stuff that happened. But there was one particular night I want to tell you when I hit my bottom. You hear a lot of times about the alcoholics sharing about hitting their bottom. Sissy hit her bottom. And I remember it. It was on a night before my mother made the final decision to do something about her drinking. I remember specifically my father had chosen to work late. He had done that many, many times to keep from coming home and dealing with it. My brother had gotten on his dirt bike once again and gone and left the house, and I was at home with my mom. And she came into the living room and asked permission to go to the store. This is the relationship now we had. She had to ask permission to do things from her 11 and a half, 12-year-old daughter. And she came in the living room to ask permission to go to the store, and it was for something trivial, like a loaf of bread or a gallon of milk or something. And I knew it was not for that. I knew that she was out of alcohol. And I gave her permission to go. And she got in her car, and she left. And the store was not far from the house, maybe a block, two blocks from the house, but she was gone for a long time. And I began to worry. I couldn't figure out what was taking so long. And I began to worry, thinking, well, maybe she finally just decided not to come back. She's threatened that before. Maybe this time she just decided not to come back. And so I found myself out in the front yard. And I thought, oh, no, I hope she really didn't decide not to come back. What would we do? And then my thoughts turned to, maybe she missed that curve on Dead Man's Curve. Oh, no, what would I do? What would I do? What would I do? And my thoughts were racing towards, what if she wrapped her car around the tree on Dead Man's Curve? And I started to panic. And I started to think of all these horrible things of what could happen. And my next thought was, Sissy, you need to pray. You need to pray. And my thought right following that was, you don't know how to pray. You don't know how to pray. And I didn't. I didn't know how to pray. And I realized that. I didn't know how to pray because the only time I had ever been to church in my life up to that point had any kind of contact with God or a spiritual being was when the youth group in our local town was going to Six Flags or the beach or some kind of trip, and you had to qualify for it. You had to go to a certain number of services at the local Baptist church. Y'all know what I'm talking about. Amen. Amen, sister. And I got real religious real quick to qualify for whatever trip we were going on. And I'd go down to the local Baptist church and join the youth group so that I could go to whatever trip or function they were going on. And, you know, I would do that and go on the trip, and then I was just through with that. And I, you know, my concept of God at that time was some being somewhere that sat up on a throne and had a list, you know, had a piece of paper in their hand with a marker. And when Sissy did something good, she got a check. When Sissy did something bad, she got a check. And then when Sissy died one day and hit the pearly gates, whichever list had more checks was where she was going. That was, you know, God to me. And I knew which list had more checks in it, and, you know, I pretty much knew my fate, so based on my behavior. So I'm standing there in the front yard thinking the only way I knew how to pray was put my hands together, get down on my knees, close my eyes, and look upward. And that's exactly what I did. I TV prayed is what I did. And I got down on my knees, and I put my hands together and closed my eyes and looked upward, and I very, very sincerely at that time, to the best of my ability, said something like, Dear God, please bring my mother home safely. Dear God, if you bring my mother home safely, I promise I will never, ever say those things to my mother again. Dear God, I promise to never use that language with her again. I promise to never talk to her like that again. I promise I'll be a good daughter. Please, God, bring my mother home safely. Thank you sincerely, Sissy in Alabama. You know, gave my address, I think, and said amen and got up. And I meant it. That's all I knew how to do. I meant it and opened my eyes and looked around, and I didn't see a flashlight and a burning bush, and I thought it was a load of crap. And I said, well, that's just a joke, because I wanted immediate results, and it didn't happen. And I thought, well, what a joke. And started to go back in the house. And when I hit the front door, I saw lights coming into the driveway, and it was her car, and I walked over to her car, and her window was down at her driver's side, and I very, very clearly remember walking over there, and I reached through the window, and I remember grabbing my mother by the collar of her shirt, saying something to the effect of, if you ever do this to me again, I will kill you. And I'm 12 and a half years old, screaming at her at the top of my lungs. And had you tapped me on the shoulder, this is the real insane part, had you tapped me on the shoulder at that moment and asked me, Sissy, are you okay? Is everything all right? I would have stood up and gathered myself and smiled at you, and I would have responded, oh, thanks for asking. Everything's just fine. Because I would have tried to convince you at that moment that everything was just fine in my life. Thanks for asking, and everything's okay. Because I didn't want you to think that alcoholism had affected me. Her drinking was her problem. Didn't affect me in any way. And I still hear people say, my drinking didn't affect my kids. And I'm 12 and a half years old, grabbing my mother's collar, slinging her around the front seat of her own car. And that's absolutely insane to me. It still gives me goosebumps around the nape of my neck. It makes a hair raise on my neck, because that's absolutely insane. That's what alcoholism did to me. And it's pretty terrifying. I don't know what happened after then. All I know is that got my attention. I don't know the timeline after that. All I know is not too long after that, my mother came to me and my brother and my dad and said she had made a phone call to a treatment center and said that she had talked to them about going in for her drinking. And I didn't understand what that meant. So I went to the only person who had all the answers at that time in my life, and that was my older brother. Because I thought, well, you know, if older brothers don't know the answer, they make them up. And that pretty much satisfied me. So I went to Mike, and I said, what's this detox thing? What's this treatment center? He said, well, it's kind of like going in and getting your oil changed. Taking your car in. He said, you know, they'll give her a shot, a pill, whatever. She won't drink anymore. Everything will be fine. And I thought, what'd she wait so long for? Why didn't she do this earlier? You know, what's the holdup? Why didn't we hear about this place earlier? But I knew she was serious about it because the treatment center called back and said, Shirley, we'd love to help you, but we need more than your Sears credit card, information. And I thought, well, maybe she did call him. So we load up on a middle of the summer. I think it was a Thursday morning in the middle of summer. I think this was my first resentment before I knew about it. It's middle of the summer, and we have to get up at the crack of dawn, take my mother to this treatment center. You'd think we're going for a trip to the beach, because you have to picture this. We have a pickup truck. Mm-hmm. In Alabama, everybody has a pickup truck. And in the back of this pickup truck are two lounge chairs. Now, an hour before this trip, my brother gets on his dirt bike, goes to Hardee's, and gets biscuits for everybody. Biscuits for everybody. Because we're taking mother to treatment. Everybody's got to have a biscuit before we go to treatment. That's insane in itself. But we get this pickup truck together, and in the back of this pickup truck are two lounge chairs. Not folding chairs, lounge chairs. You know, for your legs to stretch out on. And Mike and I each have a lounge chair, and in between these lounge chairs is a cooler of soft drink. Cokes is what we call it. Y'all call them pops. We call them Cokes. Cooler of Coke. And on top of this cooler is the biggest, loudest, eats the most batteries boombox you could find sitting right between us. And we're kicked out on these lounge chairs with the cooler and the boombox. And in the cab of the pickup truck is my dad driving and my mother with her one little suitcase and a curling iron. You know, curling iron. Curling iron's for your hair. And holding a curling iron. And off we go to treatment. And we look like we're headed to the beach, but we're off to treatment. And had you asked us where we were going, I'm not so sure we would have told you, but it looked like we're headed to the beach. And we get on the interstate, and we've got to go about 60 miles north to Warrior. Up there, and it's just insane. And we're going from a wet county into a dry county. Yeah, and off the interstate is a big billboard. It says, last chance. Last chance beverages. And I'm 13 years old. I'm thinking, hey, if it's me and I got to give it up, I would want one for the road, last chance, give it up totally, blow it out. That's what I'm thinking as a 13-year-old. So I poke my head through the cab of this truck because I've yet to figure out why she's carrying this car in there. And I'm thinking, I think I even talked to Mike about it. Wouldn't you think that if you're going to give it up, you'd want to give it up with a bang? What do you think we talked to Mom about pulling over here and letting her just have, one more for the road? And we think it's a good idea, so I'm voted to poke my head into the cab of this truck. An offer that we pull off at this last chance beverages for her to get one more for the road. And I did. I poked my head into the cab of this truck. And then I learned why she's carrying that curling iron with her. It was as a weapon. She came at me with that curling iron, made it real clear she didn't want one more for the road. And for me to get back into my lounge chair. So we made it up to the treatment center and just dropped her off. That was something else that was real crazy. We just dropped her off. Like, well, here she is. And she's standing at this big plate glass window. It was like a sad movie. With her suitcase and her curling iron, and she's waving goodbye. And we're driving off in the pickup truck, waving. And as we're getting further and further apart. And we just dropped her off. And we just left her there. Like, she was there for an oil change. And I didn't know what they were going to do with her. I thought they'd give her a pill or a shot, and they'd call us when she was ready. And we left. And we go back home, and, you know, it's the middle of summer, and my dad says, you know, what's for dinner? And I'm like, I don't cook. I don't know how to cook. My mother, I'm sure, tried to teach me how to cook. I don't cook. And he made me get in there and learn how to cook and do all these. It's a wonder we didn't die in those 38 days that she was at treatment. Or burn the house down or poison one another, because we'd never functioned without her for 38 days at a time. And here we had to. And it was a miracle that we didn't die, because we had never lived a 24-hour period, I don't think, without my mother. And we somehow survived. But, you know, this is a miracle of it, is at that time in 1982, we had a lot of treatment centers opening up in our area, a lot. And some of them were not 12-step based. Some of them did not believe in the family disease of alcoholism, period. They didn't include the family. And this one did. And the miracle of it is we wouldn't have known the difference, you know. We would not have known the difference. And we got directed by God. We got directed to a facility that believed wholeheartedly in the disease of alcoholism as a family disease. Because these people called us up there and invited us to something called Family Week. And I called it Hell Week. Because they didn't have modern conveniences like a game room or a swimming pool or cable TV or anything like that. They had therapy. They had things like that, and they had things called Al-Anon meetings and Alateen meetings that Mike and I had to go to, and they wanted us to learn everything that we could learn in a very short period of time about my mother's disease, and we did. And on the day that we went and picked my mother up, they called us in the office. I'll never forget this. I don't remember a whole lot about it, but I remember this. They sat us down in the office and they looked at us and they said, "Shirley, if you're going to stay sober, you will go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And Bo, if you're going to have any sanity, you will go to Al-Anon. And if the two of you are going to be any kind of parents to these two teenagers, you will get them involved in Alateen, period." They didn't say, "We hope to see you go," or "We strongly suggest," or "We want you to attend 6 meetings." They said, "If Shirley, you're going to stay sober, you will do this. And if you want that, then you will do this." And we picked my mother up on a Saturday in the pickup truck and brought her. We made one stop, and we brought her. We stopped off at Burger King because we thought she'd been too long without normal food. And made her eat a Whopper. And we left. We didn't even go home. We didn't even go home. We left that treatment center and made one stop. And from there, we went to this place in Bessemer, Alabama. And it was a brick building. I'd been by it a million times in my life. And it had two letters on the side of that building. It had AA on the side of that building. And every time I'd been by that building, up until then, I thought it stood for American Airlines, and they only worked at night. Y'all, I'm going to tell you how green I was when I came to this program. Oh, it's funny, when I laugh about it just like y'all do, but I literally had not a clue when I got here. Not a clue. And we pulled up in the parking lot of this building that had AA on the side of it, and I looked at my dad, and I said, "Oh." He said, "It's Alcoholics Anonymous." And I heard some words spoken to us. And when I hear them today, I still get goosebumps.
I said, get in the car. We got out of our car, and we got in their car. Those words carried us for the first several years of our life into this program. Get in the car. You don't hear it much anymore, but they absolutely saved our life into this program. Carried us for the first several years. Get in the car. We got out of our car, we got into their car. And when we got in their car, we left that parking lot and we drove 40 miles down to Tuscaloosa, University of Alabama campus. Roll Tide. And we walked into this building, and this building was probably twice the size. It was an auditorium about twice the size of this one. And there were all these people in there. And they were celebrating an anniversary of a group in Alcoholics Anonymous and a group of Al-Anon, Tuscaloosa group. Happens to be my home group today. And there was all these people there, and they just enjoyed being there, and they wanted to be there, and they were cleaned up, and they smelled good, and they looked good, and they just were having a ball. And people were explaining things to us and telling us things, and they were welcoming us, and I never felt so at home. And there was a speaker. They had a speaker that got up as we sat down after eating. There's a lady that got up and she said, hi, my name is so-and-so and I'm an alcoholic. It's my first speaker meeting ever. And she got up and she said, hi, my name is so-and-so and I'm an alcoholic. And I remember elbowing my dad. I said, isn't that neat? There's two of them. And I was so serious. I thought there was that lady and my mom. And of all the places in the world, we found her. I had no idea. No idea what we were getting into. No idea. You know, and they raffled off a University of Alabama football, and I didn't win. And I was like, oh, man, oh. You know, and there were all these kids, all these teenagers over to one side. And they had their own table and their own food and own stuff. And I said, well, what are they? And they said, oh, those are Alateens. I thought that meant like little alcoholics or something. I didn't know. And somebody said, oh, no, you're going to start an Alateen Tuesday. And I said, yes, ma'am, okay. Yeah. But we left there that night, and we just had this fire in us, four of us. We couldn't wait for the next thing. And we got back to the Bessemer group where those two A's were on that building, and they said, okay, get out of our car and get in your car and go home. And we did. And we walked in for the first time in 38 days that my mom had been home with us now in 38 days. You know what? We left the big drapes open and we left the big wooden front door open. And we didn't mind if you walked by on the sidewalk and looked in our living room. We didn't mind it. My mom went in the kitchen. She got a half gallon of milk and we got some cookies. And the four of us sat around in the living room and we just kind of looked at each other like, wow, what did we just go through? Wow. And the four of us sat down and we decided that, you know, as if we're going to do this, but we're going to do this together. It's not just about her going to her meetings, and we're going to do this together, the four of us, and we're going to do whatever it takes because we liked whatever those people had and we wanted it. And that's what we started doing. On Tuesday night, Mike and I started in on Alateen. That next week, my dad started in on Al-Anon at Bessemer. 24 years later, that's still his home group. July the 29th of this year, my mother will celebrate 24 years sobriety at that group. That's because of you. That ain't because of anything we did. That's because of you. That's because we kept hearing, get in the car. See, the way it would work is the phone would ring at the house, and they would say things like, we're going to be there at 6 o'clock, and when we pull up and honk, get in the car. Because we didn't know, go to this meeting, you need to go to this meeting, you need to try this, you need to do this. All we heard was get in the car. I told my dad years later, I said, I thought that was the first step for the longest time. Because that's all I heard was get in the car. And I spent my, you know, when kids my age were growing up going to football games and pep rallies, and I was at big book studies and potlucks and anniversaries, and I was going all over the state of Alabama getting in the car. You know, I was hand fed on the big book from age 13 to 17, you know, growing up in these things at the big book studies. And I'm from the old school. I was brought up by these seasoned veterans, and I had a little rough edges on me when I came in because, see, I grew up not hearing the word no a whole lot. And so you seasoned veterans, those folks, those members of Alcoholics Anonymous that I just used to be, I just would cower sometimes. I thought, oh, Lord. I'd walk in the door at Bessemer, and then one of them would walk up to me and bear hug me and hand me 50 cents at the same time and say, all right, young'un, here's 50 cents, go get you a Coke. Go to the little girl's room and sit down. Oh, yes, sir. And I would. See, my mom and dad couldn't do that just yet. They were still learning how to become parents. But those seasoned veterans could. They could come up and grab me by the hair of the head and do those things. And I would listen. They had my attention. And I would. And I learned things how to, you know, get there early and stay late. And, you know, I could clean up ashtrays long before I smoked. And I could make coffee long before I drank coffee. I'd say, I don't drink coffee. And they'd say, it don't matter. You know. And finally, one night at Big Book Study, I hollered and complained so much, somebody got up and went over and got me a Big Book. And said, now hush. So I could, you know, I could sit there and read and follow along. And then as I got older, you know, I could participate. Because I had enough, the ants in my pants had settled down enough to where I could sit down and listen and, you know, because they would tell me, you can sit down for an hour, sissy. You ain't got to get up and wander around and play and do all that. Because I had some rough edges when I got here. I wasn't perfect. And I had to learn some things. And these are some things that I still carry with me today. You know. But y'all literally carried us for the first several years. You made decisions for us that we couldn't make for our own, based on our own self, because we just didn't, the fog wasn't cleared in any of our heads for us to make decisions on our own well-being. So we were fortunate enough to have people around us that made decisions for us. Yeah. And how grateful I am for that, and I know my mom and dad are too. Because we couldn't have done that. We were in this program 6 years. 6 years when we thought the unthinkable happened. You know, we're all doing our thing. Mike, you know, my mother's sober 6 years. We're both out of school. Mike's got a full-time job. I finished my first year of college and had been home for 2 weeks. And when the three policemen knocked on the door to tell us that Mike had been killed in a car wreck. And see, I was under the belief, and I know it was a false belief, but I was under the belief for the first few years in this program that when you get here, that once you get here, you've made it. You know, all the other stuff, you've survived it, you got here now, and it's the pinnacle. You know, it's you know, it's just the best it's going to get is here. And I was under that belief that, you know, everything now is just going to be perfect and stay perfect, because my mom is sober, and you know, sober's as high as you get, and that's okay. And so my world pretty much came crashing down, because not only did he die in a car wreck, but he was hit and killed by a drunk driver. And that to me just wasn't supposed to happen. So I went back to that. You know, I had established the relationship with God, and I had done all the things that I thought I was supposed to do, and I had, you know, and I was right back to that. What else, what have I not done? You know, what step have I not worked? What have I not done for this to have happened? But what happened is, when those three policemen knocked on that door and said those words and told us what happened, before our family could get to the house, before our blood family could get to the house, Alcoholics Anonymous was there. Al-Anon was there. It was like that. It was like that. I could remember my dad in the kitchen on the telephone talking to his sponsor. And I remember him saying, I don't want to hang up. I don't want to hang up. I can't hang up the phone. And what she was saying on the other side was, I can't come to you if you don't hang up. Bo, I can't come to you till you hang up the phone. And I reached over and I took the phone from him and I hung up the phone. But before our family could get to the house, you were there. You were there. And you didn't call and say, read page such and such, or I'll see you at the meeting, or I'll see you at the meeting Tuesday night. So you showed up and you looked at us and you said, I don't know what to do either, but I'm here and I'm going to stay. See, the women of my mother's home group from Alcoholics Anonymous, they showed up and they did things like make sure she ate half a sandwich every couple hours, and they made sure that she took a shower, you know, a hot shower every now and then. That's what the women from Alcoholics Anonymous did for my mother, for my mom. The men from Al-Anon, they showed up and looked at my dad and said, Bo, we know you want to get the shotgun and go even the score, but we're not going to let you do that. That's not going to be an option. We'll do something else, but we're not going to let you do that. You know, the Alateens that I grew up with and that I was sponsoring, the Alateens, they just showed up and camped out. Literally camped out in our front yard. Now, where do you find that anywhere else on this planet? I don't know of an organization or a group of people that get together and have that kind of power. You know, I just don't, because I've looked. And they carried us through it, and they said things like, get in the car. You know, they took us right back to the day we walked into this thing. They put their arms around us and took care of us and made decisions for us that we were not capable of making. Because that's what we do. It's what we do for one another. And walked us through it. You know? That was in 1988. May of 1988. And then when we were able to stand and walk through that and move from that, we were able to turn around from that and do that with other people in our lives when they went through similar experiences. Because that's what we do. Because that's what we do. Not too long after that, I of course went back to school. They all looked at me and said, we know you want to drop out of school. You want to drop out of college. You think your job now is to stay here and take care of your mom and dad? Well, it's not. Your job is to go back to school. So I did. I went back to college and I finished up and became self-supporting through my own contributions. And I got a job. And I called home one day close to graduation and I said, you know, I can remember years ago when I would lay awake at night in bed and I would pray that once I got old enough, I was out of here. I couldn't wait to get away from you nuts. Now I'm asking, hey, I'd kind of like to move back home. Would that be okay? And they said, come on. So after graduation from college, I moved back home and lived with mom and dad for a while. And I went to my mother one day and I said, you know, I said, when's it going to happen for me? I said, you know, I named off all these friends of mine who were now married and had families. And I said, when's that knight in shining armor going to, you know, run into my life? And she looked at me, my mother, with all her wisdom, looked at me and said, God's not through working on him yet. I said, what's wrong with him? What's wrong with him? And then she said, you know, you just got to have patience. God's not through working on me. I said, well, you know, what's wrong with him? But anyway, I thought to myself, I'm going to help God. You know how we do. You know how we do. So I started helping God at night. In my prayers, I would help God. And I would say, okay, God, I know you're working on this knight in shining armor thing, but I'm going to just
help it up a little bit and cross some things off of your list that, you know, that way you won't have to fool with it. And I said, so, you know, they're going to have to be in the program of some sort. And I said, so, I said, you know, my dad's requiring a 5-year chip, so you need to know that. I mean, you know, he just was. And I said, but in addition to that, I said, I don't like ponytails. I'm really not into earrings. And please God, nobody with kids. Okay? Other than that, knock yourself out. And, you know, you laugh, but you women, you know what I'm talking about. So I was just trying to cut to the chase with it. So, you know, when you quit praying about things, stuff happens. I mean, when you stop looking around and, you know, focusing in on it, stuff happens. So lo and behold, here comes Bob Country into my life with a gorgeous, gorgeous ponytail at that time. A beautiful earring and 2 children. So all I can tell you is, you know, just God wasn't listening. Other than that, it's all good. And you can see what 10 years of marriage will do to your hair. Actually, it's 10 years of living with an Al-Anon. That's the power of living with an Al-Anon, 10 years. The earring's long gone, but we still have the kids. Couldn't do nothing with that. Couldn't figure a way out of that. 10 years now. Just celebrated 10 years this February. So that's pretty powerful. And that's been an exciting ride. I'll just tell you that. That's been an exciting ride. He did have the 5-year chip, by the way. So he will celebrate 15 years this year, this August. If he behaves. And at times, Bob and I have been labeled medical train wrecks, but we know now today that we are medical miracles. In 1999, I had a brain aneurysm, and it took a long time to diagnose and a very quick time to get to the operating table, and it was diagnosed as fatal, period. There is no alternative to a brain aneurysm except to rupture and die or to get in there and clip it. And I don't have time to get into the long, drawn-out story about it other than obviously the operation was a success. Now, those of you that are looking for a spiritual experience, I'm not advocating brain surgery. But if you need to go that route, it's very, very powerful. Very, very powerful experience. For me, at least, it was the most spiritual walk that I've had in a long time. I don't plan on taking another one, but I think one is enough for a lifetime. But I will tell you that there were things that happened on that in that situation that can't be anything other than just absolute spiritual in nature. You don't expect your brain surgeon to be one of the most spiritual people that you ever come in contact with that's not in the program. You don't expect a brain surgeon to be spiritual at all. But when I met the person that eventually became the one I chose to be my surgeon, Bob was not able to be with me during that visit. He had to go and make arrangements to be off work. And so I had to take my dad. My mom had to make arrangements to be off work. So I took my dad with me, and he was very resistant about going. He didn't want to be a part of it because he was struggling with the losing Mike situation. He was struggling with his own deal about he done lost one kid. He wasn't about to give up another. So he was having a problem with it. But I got him to go with me. And he sat in there with me in the doctor's in the room, and the doctor came in there. And the very first thing the surgeon told me, he said, we can clip the aneurysm. He said, that's not a problem. He said, we can get in there and take care of that medically. He said, but I need to talk to you about
your relationship with your God. And for an hour and a half, the man that ended up being my brain surgeon and I and my father talked about God. Now, I had never been in the hospital to that point. I had never been operated on. I had never been put to sleep. So I was facing a big one. And I had a lot of fear. And he took my hand and my dad's hand, and we held hands. And for an hour and a half, we talked about God's love. We talked about the power of God. And he said, if you're willing to be a good patient, he said, God's willing to restore you to good health, you know. And he said, it's just unimaginable that you would have that kind of conversation with a man that thinks he can fix everything, you know, with a man of that kind of skill. So it was very, very enlightening to sit there and have that kind of conversation. At the end of it, my dad was able to look at him and say, I give you my daughter, please fix her. And he was able to get some freedom from that and ended up being able to be a part of the surgery and my recovery. Now, they did shave every pretty little hair off my head and give me one heck of a scar and put me down for about 6 months, but it's taken a while to recover from that. That's not something you just bounce back from. But there again, AA and Al-Anon and the program of Alateen surrounded our family and put their arms around them and said, we're going to walk right beside you with it. I was supposed to stay in the hospital about 14 days, and on the seventh day, my surgeon walked in and said, you're not sick enough to be here. I'm sending you home. And take all of them in that room with you. And we knew what that meant. And he said something about, and all that coffee and pizza with you. So, you know, all of them, take all of them too. And we went home and started the recovery. And it wasn't 2 years later when we were sitting in the doctor's office and we thought Bob was having some back pain, and it turned out to be cancer of the kidney. And they said, there's only one way to do it. We got to go in there and take the kidney. And you're sitting there and you're faced with these alternatives that are not fun alternatives at all. But you put one foot in front of the other and you keep doing what's, you know, the next thing. And you get through it. And you go back to your meetings and you share about it and you talk to people. And you let them know what's going on. And somehow you just find your way at the other side of it. And that's what we've done for the last few years. This past February, finished up surgery number 9 to continue to fix hernias on the poor boy. They just keep coming back, these hernias. And we just keep fixing them. And we're establishing real good relationships with the people, you know, down at the hospital. And, you know, we keep asking them, well, can he travel? Well, can he travel? And they're like, we'll get him ready. We'll get him ready. So we just keep doing the next right thing, thinking, well, it's going to work out. So that's what we do. And that's what we encourage the people that, you know, come in the program and decide that they want this way of life, that that's what they need to do, you know. Surround themselves with good, healthy people and keep doing the next right thing, and then it's going to work out. You know, I figure today, the biggest problem I have in my life today is my attitude. If I can work on that, I'm going to have a pretty good day. Everything else can be, you know, worked out. So I figured I got it pretty good. I've come a long way. I still got a long way to go. But I'll take today over anything I had before I got here. Anytime. It's absolutely anytime. So, you know, that's a day in the life of Sissy Country. If you're ever down in West Blockton, Alabama, please keep in mind there is no Blockton, Alabama. There is no East Blockton or South or North Blockton. There's only West Blockton. So, you know, don't get too confused when you come down there. I want to close by reading just a few lines out of my favorite page in Courage to Change,
those of you that read this book should have read it just a few days ago on April the 4th, and it will sum up for you pretty much the way, exactly the way I am. So on April the 4th, page 95. Says, I used to love the stillness of early morning, but over the years of living with an alcoholic, I stopped noticing it. Instead, I woke up the same way I went to sleep, frantic. Before I was out of bed, I already had a long list of crises that needed my attention. So no matter how early I got up, I was already late. Sometimes I was so overwhelmed I couldn't get up at all. My life has changed. I heard someone in Al-Anon say that when they open their eyes in the morning, they also open their ears. Al-Anon is helping me to clear my mind of my burdens so that I'm able to enjoy the wonder of the moment. I'm beginning to enjoy a childlike awe about the splendor of nature, see the beauty all around me, to let my face break into a smile spontaneously, to laugh, to love, to live again. Today I can say, good morning, God. Instead of good God, it's morning. Thank you and God bless.